crosses. Jesus carried one, literally, and his followers have been asked to shoulder them ever since. Does the cross play a role in your existence? To be quite honest, I don't expect many of us feel its crushing weight or bear its splinters in our hands, but if we are Christ's people, it should be something more than a vague memory and an empty metaphor.
That's the Reverend Dr. Bob Baggett, and today he brings you a challenging message of faith and hope. I'm Peter Wallace. This is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. In 2015, we're celebrating 70 years of faithful weekly broadcasts, beginning in 1945 as the Protestant Hour and continuing since 2002 as Day One. Now, here's our host, Peter Wallace, to introduce this week's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to welcome the Reverend Dr. Robert T. Baggett III, Senior Minister of the Community Church of Vero Beach, Florida, a United Church of Christ. Bob earned a bachelor's degree from Samford University, a Master of Divinity degree from the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, and a Doctor of Ministry degree from Graduate Theological Foundation in South Bend, Indiana. Prior to accepting the call to Vero Beach in 2004, he served churches in Atlanta, Miami, and Minneapolis. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You and your wife, Casey, were last with us in late 2012, and we'll hear from Casey on our program on April 12th. Together, you've served Community Church of Vero Beach for over 10 years now, so tell us what's happening there these days.
Well, we're still marching on, trying to be the church, which means a lot of different things. We've been toying with worship a little bit now. Mm-hmm. After we've been there a while, you have a little more trust, and you can move a little more of the furniture around. Mm-hmm. And so that's been an exciting time to experience some different worship styles.
Tell us about that, especially the contemporary service you started.
Yeah, we've started a service called C2, which is Community 2. It's a contemporary service that meets in our community hall. We've been very pleased with it. We've kind of watched contemporary worship around the church world and tried to glean from it what worked, but more importantly, what didn't work. And we are running it simultaneously with one of our four services, which gives us an opportunity to bring the congregation together when both services are over.
But they also hear the same sermon.
Yeah, one of the things we found is it was a challenge running different services with different personalities because the community of faith was experiencing different leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exciting. At the same time, in a large community like our congregation, it also can lead sometime to some fracturing of mm-hmm. the community and a following of certain teaching styles or theological understandings. And so we decided we would find a new way to do it, and we coined a word called ECAST, which I don't even know what it means other than the fact that we tape the sermon on a Thursday or Friday, and then we run the sermon in that contemporary service in a more laid-back atmosphere, but they're receiving the same sermon as the other mm-hmm. three services of the morning.
And you and Casey serve as a pastoral team. What are the advantages of that for you and the congregation?
I think the first advantage is personal. I think we both understand the pressure that clergy face. And so when we come home, there's an understanding of how mm-hmm. we might be feeling, mm-hmm. anxiety, nervous, angry, full of joy. And so we're able to not have a chasm between work and home if we need it.
And preaching has been a vital part of your ministry over the years, and you've had the occasion to preach in a number of wonderful places or for very meaningful events. Tell us about a couple of those experiences that stand out for you.
Probably one of the most moving for me was the year anniversary of Pan Am 103 back when I was a young preacher. Why it was moving for me was, first of all, it was, of course, a very tragic mm-hmm. time, and so there was so much grief and pain in that space at the National Cathedral. But secondly, it was a growing point for me because I did not belong there. Mm. I had not formed as a preacher, as a minister, or formed enough spiritually to really have words of wisdom to say to people who had been that fractured in their dreams, their world. And it kind of taught me that, you know, ministers, we don't know everything, and sometimes we need to admit that.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, we are in the season of Lent in the church year, And your sermon is based on the gospel lesson for this Sunday, Mark chapter 8, verses 31 to 38. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels."
So Jesus spells out what he expects of his followers, to deny themselves and take up their cross and follow him. Bob, we look forward to learning a little more about what this means for us in your sermon, Cross Purposes. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
And if you'd like to listen again to today's program or read or share a transcript of Bob Baggett's sermon, visit our website at dayone.org. Or for a free printed sermon transcript, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1.
One of my all-time favorite cartoons comes from The New Yorker magazine. It shows two businessmen sitting at a bar, one clearly despondent. The unhappy one says to his companion, "I was on the cutting edge. I pushed the envelope. I did the heavy lifting. I was the rainmaker. Then suddenly it all crashed when I ran out of metaphors." Metaphors. They clearly play a significant role in our lives, don't they? Not just as linguistic tools, but as much more. Metaphors shape our thinking, convey philosophy, and even express theological concepts. Of course, metaphors, whether pithy and catchy or deep and extensive, are not simply a modern communication phenomenon. In fact, they are probably as old as human language. For example, we know that the master teacher Jesus taught in parables, sort of extended metaphors, beautiful symbolic stories that provoke contemplation and challenge the status quo. Symbolic language was prevalent in Jesus' teachings. "I am the vine, you are the branches. I am the light of the world." And he tells us about the pearl of great price, the wheat and the tares, and the house built on shifting sand. Unlike our businessman in the New Yorker cartoon, Jesus never seemed to run out of metaphors. So not surprisingly, across the centuries, there has arisen dispute about metaphoric language in the Bible. Is it really justifiable to take the language of the Bible metaphorically? Or does reverence for the text require us to understand them as literally as possible? It's a controversy of real importance, I think, because what is conveyed in the biblical language is so significant to us all. We do not want to miss a shred of the meaning intended for us. So how would you understand today's text? Metaphorically? Literally? "If any want to become my followers," Jesus said, "let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." As Steve Garnes Holmes has said, the cross in Jesus' day was not a logo or a metaphor. The cross was an instrument of pain, shame, absolute loss, and death. It was a real weapon. The only way to take it up was to become its real victim. When Jesus picked up his cross, it was to set himself against the Roman Empire and the temple authorities, against the ideology of the world that oppressed and shackled God's people, and against everything that hindered the inbreaking of God's kingdom to come. He picked up the cross to go to his death, literally. But when the writer of Mark's gospel related Jesus' teachings on the matter,
We see that something new was slipping into the meaning and implication of cross-bearing because, as Jesus told it, every one of his followers must bear a cross. Then, will every one of Jesus' followers face his same cruel and tragic death? Well, in Mark's day, the threat of crucifixion was still there. As this gospel was being written some 40 or so years after Jesus' death, conflict was everywhere. Social, political, and religious instability were inescapable. Rome was appointing a new Caesar after Nero had died. The temple in Jerusalem was under siege and soon to be destroyed. While Jews were divided over supporting Rome or rising up against it, and the fledgling band of Jesus' followers were caught in the middle. Their beliefs neither persuaded them to fight Rome nor encouraged them to support it. Neighborhoods were divided. Families were divided. It was a difficult, desperate, and dangerous time. This line from Mark's gospel about cross-bearing reminded Christ's very early band of followers of the cross's very literal potential to take life. Depending on the choices they made, indeed, it might take theirs. But also this line spoken by Jesus would have reminded them of the prospect the cross offered to help them gain everything. I have a clergy friend whose grandfather knew a lot about crosses, literally. As my friend tells it, back in the 1950s, his grandfather was a grand wizard of the KKK. On more than one occasion, his grandfather had led other men in erecting and burning crosses on public property, on private lawns. What motivated the use of these crosses for this purpose? Hatred, animosity, hostility, bitterness, ignorance. All these were driving forces in the life of my friend's grandfather. The implementation of the cross and expressing them scarred many innocent people for life. My friend doesn't speak much about this horrific period in his family's past. In fact, only a few of his close friends know of its existence at all. But knowing something of it, one night I gathered the courage to ask him how he had reconciled himself to that portion of his family history. He smiled quietly and responded this way. "Well, you see, my grandfather went through a conversion experience in midlife, and the cross began to play a very different role for him. It had been for him an emblem by which he spewed hatred. But one day, my grandfather said, as the stories of Scripture were read in his church, he heard the line about taking up his cross. He realized then that every cross he had picked up, he had misused. And so my grandfather said he knelt and prayed for a little guidance on the matter, and God showed him what to do with his cross. My grandfather said he nailed his rage upon that cross and let it die there. And with that death, something new came to life within him." Then my friend went on to say that that decision had made all the difference in his grandfather's life, which was clear from what happened years later. "I'd been invited to play at a golf course located in my grandfather's hometown," my friend said. "A green van from the golf club picked me up at the airport along with several friends. The driver of the van introduced himself as Carlton. He picked up the golf bags and luggage, then off we went. Driving through my grandfather's hometown in that van, I told my friends about my own family history there. Not the KKK part, of course. For the rest of the story," my friend said. "I even pointed out the downtown block where my grandfather had owned a loan company and pawn shops for many years. When we arrived at the golf club, Carlton, the driver, walked around to the back of the van and began to unload bags one by one. Each of my golfing friends walked away until I was the only one left with the driver of the van. When Carlton handed me my bags, he said, 'I knew your grandfather. In fact, after your grandfather's conversion, he was a changed man. If it weren't for him, many of my people would have gone hungry. He was always willing to give you money if you needed it. Loaned it to you sometimes for no interest if you were really hard up. He was a good Christian man, and you should be proud.'" How about that? From a grand wizard to a humble Christian with the heart of a servant. The power of the cross. If I were to ask you if the cross still had its uses for your life and mine, what would you say? Of course, The cross is no longer employed as the Romans used it in Jesus' day to put insurrectionists to their literal deaths. So powerful, so formative is the cross in Christian identity that its potential lives on, doesn't it? Now, in modern times, perhaps we could understand the cross to be the place of our ultimate transformation, a place to hang our arrogance, our rage, our bitterness, our prejudice, our greed, and then let them die, so that something more eternally good and grace-filled and Christ-like may be resurrected. So let me ask, what do you need to hang on the cross this day? Is there something within you or around you that should be hung there? Does something in your life need to die for something else more gracious, good, and generative to live? Think of the hundreds and thousands of Christians who have trusted in the cross's power to change things, whether in their own personal hearts and souls, or whether a change was required because of a social condition, a political injustice, or a national disgrace. Let's make no mistake. Such cross-bearers often carry a heavy, heavy load as they take their crosses up to follow Jesus. But they have done it time and again with the sure and certain conviction that the potential and the power of the cross that burst into the world when Jesus first shouldered it is now acceptable to every Christian. The cross is now our means to grasp and enlist the transformative power which is capable of making God's kingdom more fully present among us. Perhaps one of the most stirring examples of cross-bearing I know comes from the story of William Wilberforce. Few of us know his name, but we all see the result of his walk with Jesus and the cross. As observers have noted in reading Gerhard Coulson's book, Kingdoms in Conflict, it all began in 1787 in London. London was prosperous in those days, but decadent. The Industrial Revolution was swinging into full gear, and tired children worked excruciating 18-hour workdays. A significant portion of the economy was run by British ship captains who serviced the British plantation industry in the West Indies. Their cargo? Human beings. Human beings who were captured in Africa and auctioned into slavery. In these tumultuous times, when exploitation and unrest were rampant, few gave a second glance to the tragedy of black African slavery. However, Wilberforce felt the weight of his Christian convictions and could not deny them. The young politician, only 29 years old, introduced the first bill into Parliament in 1788, proposing to abolish slave trade. It was soundly defeated. So Wilberforce began a campaign with other Christian abolitionists. They distributed pamphlets. They spoke at public meetings. They circulated petitions. They wrote songs. They organized boycotts of slave-grown sugar. But public sentiment was not easily changed. Wilberforce was mocked in the press, humiliated in the halls of government, even challenged to a duel by one self-righteous plantation owner who felt he'd been unfairly maligned by Wilberforce's campaign to change public opinion on slavery. And yet, Wilberforce carried on unremittingly. Year after year after year, bills were proposed. Year after year after year, those bills proposed to abolish slavery were defeated. But finally, after many arduous years, Wilberforce saw the change he dreamed of. An abolition bill was again introduced to Parliament in the House of Lords and in the House of Commons. And just before the vote was called, one member rose to give a stirring tribute to William Wilberforce and his unwavering conviction to end an evil. Then the vote was taken, 16 nay and 283 yea. At last, the motion carried overwhelmingly, and Wilberforce sat quietly, head bowed, tears flowing down his wrinkled face. What an impressive story. One man who breathed like us, walked like us, thought and spoke and talked like us, accomplished the extraordinary because he did all those things in the company of Jesus. And while Wilberforce metaphorically shouldered his cross, all the while he hung upon it the shame of slavery until it died there. And what happened then? Freedom,
literally came to life. Crosses. Jesus carried one, literally, and his followers have been asked to shoulder them ever since. Does the cross play a role in your existence? To be quite honest, I don't expect many of us feel its crushing weight or bear its splinters in our hands, but if we are Christ's people, it should be something more than a vague memory and an empty metaphor. The cross, all it means, all the power it holds, all the transformation it enables, ought to stand central to our lives. Auguste Rodin was a wonderful French sculptor who one day found an enormous, carefully carved wooden crucifix beside a road. Rodin bought that cross he so admired and had it carted to his home. But when it arrived, he found that the cross was too big to fit inside his house. So what did he do? He knocked down the walls, raised the roof, and rebuilt his home around that cross. Now, isn't that a wonderful metaphor? What if the cross was central to our lives, to our homes, to our very being? What if we lived under its shadow every day? What if it stood so near that we could pick it up whenever its power was needed? What if we were poised to hang every evil on it, every injustice on it, every hardship and pain on it, to let the cross do its work as it has for millions of people for thousands of years? Then it would be more than an empty metaphor. It would still be doing its work. And what's more, we who are the agents that employed that cross would be God's agents of transformation. We would be, metaphorically, the cutting edge, pushing the envelope, doing the heavy lifting, the rainmakers. Take up your cross and follow me, Jesus says. What greater call could we ever accept than that? Amen.
This is Sherry Miller. How is the Day One Ministry helping people and why should you support it? Brenda, a listener in Pennsylvania, says, "Every Sunday, Day One gives me a message I can carry throughout my week." Mike in Minnesota says, "There's not another program like Day One. It allows you to hear the Word of God from so many gifted voices." Please give generously so that Day One can continue to proclaim this much-needed message on the radio and online in the year ahead. Mail your gift to Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. That's 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. Or call us at 1-888-411-DAY1. Or give securely online at dayone.org. On behalf of everyone at Day One, thank you for your support. Bob Beckett offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Bob, thank you for a powerful sermon on the cross of Jesus. You said in Jesus' day and in Mark's when he wrote the gospel that the threat of physical crucifixion was still real, and it must have been terrifying. But Jesus took up his cross to set himself against the Roman Empire and the temple authorities, against the ideology of the world that oppressed and shackled God's people, and against everything that hindered the inbreaking of God's kingdom to come, you said. That's powerful. How might we today pick up our cross to follow his example and do the same sort of thing?
You know, Peter, I think the cross becomes a sense of identity for those of us who follow Christ, and therefore it compels us to take it up. And what does it look like?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it looks like how Jesus taught us to live, that when we see injustice, we step forward. Where we see a need for forgiveness or understanding, where it's not simple to do, I think it's the compelling challenge of Christianity. that when we see a need, we remember what Christ taught us about meeting that need, and we take up our cross when we address it.
You said in modern times, perhaps we can understand the cross to be a place of our ultimate transformation, a place to hang our arrogance, our rage, our bitterness, our prejudice, our greed, and then let them die so that something more eternally good and grace-filled and Christ-like may be resurrected. Can you help us get our minds and hearts around that a little better? What might happen in our lives if we did that?
You know, Peter, I think all of us as human beings respond to and are transformed by other people who believe in us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife believes in me, and therefore I'm able to be a stronger human being than without her belief in me. Our children step forward and do greater things when their parents are believing in them and affirming them. And for me, Christ's death on the cross was a statement of saying, I believe in you as a child of God. You are imbued with that divine spark within you. And so when I return to that sense of the ultimate, of giving away your life because you believe so in your followers, I'm compelled to do that myself. I have good days and bad days doing that. But on my best days, I think it's when I remember that and then I act out of that. So I think that's an amazing thought, that there is someone who believes so strongly in us that they're willing to step back from this joyous and beautiful life to allow us to have more joy and more life.
Bob, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind this week?
I think transformation. I think Lent is a time to reflect upon who we are as partners to those we love, who we are as parents, who we are as friends, and who we are as followers of Christ. And all of us have those things that we could metaphorically hang upon the cross. And for 40 days, we have a chance to reflect upon that and make that list and then do it with the promise of Easter hanging around, knowing that when it comes, all of those things can resurrect us to newness.
Bob Maggott, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.